This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we are going to be concluding our series on Quentin Tarantino, looking at his eighth film, The Hateful Eight.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get into that, before we get into anything Tarantino related, just a little bit of cool news that occurred this week with the Super Bowl and everything. There's another Cloverfield movie. We talked about Cloverfield and 10 Cloverfield Lane in our series on movies produced by J.J. Abrams. And now he's produced another one, The Cloverfield Paradox.
Surprise! It's there.
Yeah. Cloverfield in Space, you know? this is a movie which was supposed to come out in October, and then they pushed it back to February, and then they pushed it back to April. And then the rumor started going that they sold it to Netflix. And then the rumor started going that Netflix was going to release it sooner than April. And then the rumor started going that Netflix was going to debut a trailer for it during the Super Bowl, which would be their big announcement. And that's when the speculation started that they would then drop it, you know, immediately following their announcement or whatever, surprising the world. And sure enough, that's what happened. So, you know, best post-game show ever.
Here's a movie. That kind of tops Terry Bradshaw talking about anything. So,
although I have to say, I think maybe not as good as the episode of Alias, also J.J. Abrams, that debuted after the Super Bowl. That was amazing. Right. But second best, perhaps. I actually watched it because why not? It was just weird. It was like, hey, you can do this? Okay, let's do it.
This is the, you know, experiment with the release. Seriously, everybody's trying to figure out how to release movies now. Like, how much lead time do you need? How much this and that? I think this is a great experiment for them to find out, you know, hey, they come watch a movie after the Super Bowl. I want to see their numbers. I mean, I know Netflix guards them, but I'd love to find out anything about, did they get a truckload of people going over and watching the movie or, you know?
I mean, it's really smart because, well, for one thing, Cloverfield has always sort of been a thing. Like, the first trailer came out, it was attached to, I want to say it was Mission Impossible 3. Well, maybe not. Maybe it was a little later than that. But it was like a good, like, 6 months before the movie came out. Yeah. There was no title on that first trailer. It was attached to some Paramount movie. And, you know, it was labeled like Cloverfield, but everyone thought that was just like a placeholder name, you know.
Right.
Then the next, and most of the footage wasn't even actually footage in the movie. It was like test footage, which was then recreated later on because the movie hadn't been shot yet or something. Then, you know, the movie comes out or whatever. There's the whole viral marketing campaign, all that stuff. And everyone's like, what's Cloverfield? What does that mean? What's the title? You know, all that stuff. The second time they tried to kind of recapture that by surprising everyone with the release of the trailer on, I want to say it was American Sniper, like a couple months before the movie came out. No. It was the other one, 13 Hours or the Benghazi movie.
Yeah, 13 Hours. The Michael Bay one. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what it was. It debuted on that. And that was a weird one for me working at a theater because, like, there was this movie which, you know, we got trailers for called Valencia. And that was a movie which was sort of, like, known about, although, like, you know, people knew, like, oh, John Goodman and, you know, Mary Elizabeth Winstead are in it and stuff like that. But no one really knew what the plot was. And we got these trailers, like, you know, a couple days, like, you know, usually we get them, like, you know, maybe a week before the movie comes out or whatever, like Monday, you know, let's say, for a Friday release, yeah. We'll get the movie and the trailers, and usually the movies are, you know, locked and stuff like that, and you need, like, a decryption key and everything, but the trailers are just kind of there. So you just see a big list of trailers, and it's just standard, you know, whatever. So there you see Valencia, you know, pop up, and it's like, well, what's that? You know, there's a million movies, you know, every week where you're like, what's that? You know, who cares?
Yeah.
And I think it was like the Wednesday before 13 Hours came out, they said, oh, hey, there's this new movie called 10 Cloverfield Lane, and it's the trailer is going to debut, you know, tomorrow night attached to, you know, 13 Hours. And I'm like, what? You know, and then I go and look and I find this Valencia thing. And it's like, well, that's the code name that they used for 10 Cloverfield Lane. And I'm like, I literally have this trailer sitting on a server right next to me because I was at work when the news came out. So, and, you know, it was like the end of the night. So I'm like, okay, let me load it up and watch it. So, like, I went from not knowing that a Cloverfield sequel existed to watching the trailer, like, in the span of about an hour, right? Yeah. Which was crazy.
No, it is.
And then the movie came out, like, 2 months later, you know? So now for this one, it's, you know, here's a trailer for the new Cloverfield movie, and also here's the movie 3 hours later. Insane.
Yeah, I think that this sort of compressed marketing thing, you know, it makes me rethink because I know that one of the things, you know, a movie that's coming up is that the trailer dropped, you know, just this Sunday, Solo. Everybody's been like, oh, where's the trailer? This thing's, oh my gosh, we're never going to. But hearing you, you know, recount what we know about Cloverfield. Yeah, I mean, people are, who says you need 6 months or 12 months or however many months beforehand? Why do you need to, like, everything's a hype machine. Why not release the trailer right beforehand or 3 months beforehand or something? You know, like, it, you're not going to get more or less hyped, you know, between 6 months and 3 months anymore, I don't think, because there's so many trailers and so much hype for everything. I think the way you set yourself apart is you get people asking, where's the trailer for it now? I don't know.
I mean, with this Cloverfield movie, like, it literally, I mean, the reason why it's on Netflix is because they made the movie with the intention of releasing it theatrically and were like, this thing has some problems. And apparently JJ was going to go in and fix it, but then he got busy with Star Wars and everything. And basically they were like, this is a dud. If we release it in theaters, it won't make any money. So they sell it to Netflix and Netflix is able to be like, watch the new Cloverfield movie now on Netflix. And everyone's like, oh my God. And they watch the new Cloverfield movie. And then you look at the reactions the next day and everyone's like, that movie sucked. You know,
I still haven't seen it. So I will reserve judgment, but I think that, you know, I don't know. I would say that people, you know, it could even temper people's expectations. Cause like if you paid $15 and the movie was what it is, you'd probably be even angrier about its resultant outcome, whereas it's amortized within your monthly cost. So you're like, yeah, okay, I didn't like it. You're not as angry.
Right.
Like when I plunk down the money and the time and the babysitting stuff and I go see a movie and it sucks, I'm kind of angry coming out of it. I'm like, why did I do this? Why do I come out to see movies at all? But if something's streaming on Netflix and it's I'm like, yeah, you know, they tried. That's cool.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, I didn't dislike the movie. I thought it was good. You know, it's definitely the worst of the Cloverfield movies. I think the premise of it is really interesting, but I think it kind of meanders a little bit too much. there's times where it's a little too alien, like it's really, really trying to be alien. And, you know, a few things, you know, in terms of like the Cloverfield of it all are a little on the nose and sort of feel tacked on in a lot of ways. But I think on the whole, it's a really decent movie. And it was made by a bunch of Star Trek people, you know, J.J. Abrams, you know, producing, of course, but also the script was co-written, or the story is, he gets a story by credit because he did like a draft, but whatever. It's co-written by Doug Jung, the co-writer of Star Trek Beyond.
Yeah.
And the cinematographer is Dan Mindell, who we've discussed on the show, you know, for his work on
Star Trek 09, Force Awakens, Domino, everything.
Domino, all that stuff, yeah. Of course, he shot Star Trek 09 and Into Darkness. And he shot this in, you know, anamorphic 35mm, and it looks great. You know, it really does. And that's kind of the disappointing thing is, like, as someone who enjoys watching movies in the theater, like, I would have paid to see this movie on the big screen, you know?
Here's a question for you, because you mentioned how, you know, Abrams was going to go in and quote unquote fix it, and then he gets busy with Star Wars again. Do you see a movie that could have been fixed with more time? That somebody could have sat down in the editing booth and done a Stuart Baird with it and been like, okay, we can fix this.
I think it could have been a little tighter, you know, for sure. Mm-hmm. I think the concept on the whole works really well. I mean, I'm not going to get into, you know, what the concept is hardcore, because part of the fun of it is the discovery and everything. But, you know, the basic premise is, you know, Earth has an energy crisis, you know, and I mean, like, big time, like, we're about to just, you know, blink out, you know, out down on Earth. And there's a space station up, you know, orbiting Earth, which is trying to find like a new form of energy using like a particle accelerator. And the reason why they're in space is because this thing is so dangerous that they can't do it on Earth, right? And basically these people have been up there for like a couple years and have not had much success. And then they do have some success, but there's a few side effects, and that's where the story really gets going. And it's an interesting premise, for sure. I think it gets a little, I don't know, a little bogged down in a few things here and there, you know, but it's, on the whole, it's pretty good. It's very much in the vein of Alien and Event Horizon and that sort of thing.
Oh, so. Alien, yay. Event Horizon, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's better than Event Horizon. I mean, okay, not as good as Alien, better than Event Horizon. There you go.
It's a wide amount of space to navigate there.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. But some good performances. I mean, the lead is Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who was in another J.J. Abrams production, that TV show. What was the name of it? It was basically like Alias or whatever, but it was like a married couple who were spies.
Oh, I know the one. Yeah, and it didn't last very long. Right. I can't remember the name of it because it was just like shoop. It was gone inside of like four episodes, wasn't it?
Which was disappointing because it was actually really good, you know. But she's great as always, and you know, a lot of other really, you know, quality actors. Zhang Ziyi shows up. We haven't seen her in years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but I mean, worth checking out for sure, you know? Not as good as the other Cloverfield movies, but hey, I mean, if you got Netflix, why not watch it, you know?
Yeah, and honestly, you know, coming after 10 Cloverfield Lane, that's going to be a tough one to follow up in the first place, so.
Yeah. But still, a little cool bit of, you know, movie stuff, you know, movie news, and figured we should talk about that. Okay, so now on to some less cool movie news.
It is news, though. It is news.
Okay, so a lot has happened in the world of Quentin Tarantino over the past week. Uma Thurman sat down for an interview with, I believe, the New York Times.
Yeah, it was New York Times. Yep.
To discuss her relationship with Harvey Weinstein and you know, in relation to all of the, you know, harassment and everything that's going on in the industry right now, or that's coming out about, you know, harassment in the industry right now. And she was harassed by Harvey Weinstein as well.
Yes.
And she tells that story, but she also sort of like frames it in this larger context of the way that women are treated in the industry. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the things which she, you know, revealed was how she was injured in a stunt that went wrong on the set of Kill Bill. She, yep. You know, just, I mean, long story short, I guess, you know, and I mean, you can read all about it, you know, in the New York Times and even watch the footage yourself. But she was asked to drive a car which was known to be unsafe. And yes. She didn't want to do that. And Tarantino basically pressured her into doing it, and she ended up crashing the car into a tree and injuring herself pretty severely, you know?
Yes, yep.
So, you know, this, of course, you know, obviously is very problematic on a lot of levels, you know, one of them being that, you know, the studio and the producers tried to cover it up. And she was denied access to the footage for years, and Tarantino, you know, was kind of a part of that. But the other, you know, side to it is just, you know, as far as Tarantino is concerned, the idea that he would even put her in this position in the first place, the idea that he would, you know, risk his leading actress, you know,
yeah.
I mean, if it's like that's, you know, I mean, a lot of people are saying like this is how, you know, the star of the movie is being treated. Can you just imagine how, you know, everyone else is, you know, and, you know, a lot of people are outraged by it, you know, rightfully so. And, you know, a lot of people sort of have called into question whether or not Tarantino should even be making movies, because if he's, you know, going to do this on a set, then should that person be employed? Should that person be entrusted with the safety of all these people, you know, under his command? And yeah, I mean, that's obviously been all that anyone, you know, sort of in the realm of Tarantino has been talking about for, you know, the past few days. And, you know, we felt like we needed to obviously bring it up here too, because we've spent the past 2 months talking about how awesome this guy's movies are, which, you know, I mean, I don't think that that's changed at all. I mean, you know, I was reading one critic who was talking about how, you know, Kill Bill was a huge influence on her life, you know, as she was growing up. And to, you know, see this footage and to find out that, you know, Uma Thurman almost died because of Tarantino's negligence, that's, you know, profoundly disturbing. But at the same time, that doesn't necessarily mean that Kill Bill is a bad movie, you know, or your love for Kill Bill
right.
will diminish, but it will certainly change, you know, like she was saying, like you just need to recontextualize how you love that movie.
I think that it is definitely, I think that this is definitely part of a larger sort of thing that is known and talked about and regarded, but is sort of regarded as anecdotal stuff. And this is really awful what happened. And there's no other way to say it or approach it. But weird and, you know, abusive behavior by directors has been accepted as, well, these are these great artists working. Like I go back to, and the story was recalled affectionately by Max von Sydow about working on The Exorcist, about how William Friedkin would keep guns hidden on the set, and then they'd be loaded with blanks, and then the actor would be, you know, looking somewhere else or something like that, and then he would fire the gun behind them, and they'd be like, okay, roll camera, just to get them, you know, to get a real fearful reaction. Or the priest at the end who gives Father Damien last rites after he goes down the stairs, He says, if you look closely, there's a slap mark on my face, because that was what Friedkin thought he needed to do to get me to shake and be, you know, tense and everything like that. And again, this doesn't minimize anything to do with Thurman. It's more just to talk about how these artistic directors get too much leeway. And hopefully this becomes something where somebody on set will now say, you know, I mean, because yes, Tarantino is in the wrong, but why didn't the stunt coordinator, why didn't somebody else, why did they leave it to Uma Thurman to have to be the one to bear the brunt of that? Why didn't one other person step in front of that and help her? I'm not saying that that makes her weaker or anything like that, or any, you know, but like, I don't care who it is. If you, Mike, I saw somebody trying to pressure you into doing something, you're like, I don't really want to do it. And they, you know, they're really coming at you. I'm going to be like, Hey, is everything cool here? What's going on? And you know, I don't know. I mean, thank God she came through it with just injuries and not loss of life. You know, I mean, the only possible silver lining you can get out of it is that maybe this wakes a ton of people up and they say, you know what, we can't let this go on anymore. Who cares how good the movie is? You can't let people get away with things. But then, of course, you know, like you said, you layer on this other thing where the producers, you know, they have a lot to do with suppressing this footage as well. And I'm sure that they, you know, Tarantino giving the footage to her finally is a good thing. Why did it take so long?
Yeah, no, and that's definitely true. You know, it's interesting because the article, I mean, the other thing that everyone keeps on saying about this article is that it's very poorly written, which I definitely agree with, because like I read it and I'm like, what are they saying? Like, I don't understand, like, literally what they're trying to say happened, you know?
I originally took it that the interview was saying that Harvey Weinstein had cut the brakes on the car. When I first read it, I took it as an assassination attempt to shut her up about the harassment or something like that.
Yeah, it's very poorly written, but, you know, she clarified things a little bit because, you know, obviously, pretty much everyone, you know, whether in the industry or outside of the industry, you know, basically came down hard on Tarantino as soon as the article came out, you know, as they should.
Yes.
And one of the things which she kind of clarified, I guess, was that she has forgiven Tarantino and she hasn't forgiven Weinstein or two of the other producers. And, you know, because they actively tried to suppress the, you know, information about the incident and destroyed evidence and did all this stuff. And, you know, I think that that's really interesting, because until I read that from her, you know, I guess my feeling with Tarantino was like, you know, if he did this, you know, that's kind of like showing someone who has such a lack of control that really they shouldn't be, you know, given a movie, you know. And I don't know. I was very curious to see how other people in the industry would react to it, because obviously they know the job a lot better than we do, and you know how big of a, you know, betrayal this is, you know, on the part of a director or whatever. And pretty much everyone in the industry was like, yeah, this is kind of unforgivable, because you hear about like accidents, you know, on movie sets all the time. I mean, people have died, you know, just recently on a few different productions. But
yeah,
the thing that people keep on saying is like, the difference here is that accidents happen, you know, in controlled environments because of whatever. But this is a case where it should have never gotten to this point in the first place.
Yeah,
and you know, and pretty much everyone across the board, you know, everyone, because you can see the footage, you know, everyone was like, that is clearly a job for a stunt driver. Like, there's no way that an actress who is not trained as a professional, you know, driver should be doing that stunt, you know?
Right.
And I don't know, a big question that I kept on thinking was like, I mean, because this is 15 years ago. Like, if this happened like yesterday, I'd be like, okay, you know, there's no way that Tarantino should be allowed near a movie set, you know, anytime soon, right? But the fact that it's been 15 years, I guess my question is, like, has he changed? Like, was this a terrible mistake on his part that he's come to terms with and has been forgiven for, and are his sets no longer like this? And I'm not convinced that that's the case.
I'm not convinced that that's the case either, but my tendency in any situation, regardless of who it is to give the benefit of the doubt, mm-hmm. is to say human beings make mistakes, and while I would easily assign a large amount of, you know, in terms of suppressing the footage, I would probably put the lion's share on the producers, and then them pressuring Tarantino, saying, you can't give this footage, we'll all be screwed if you do it. And fear can be a very powerful motivator for people. It can make them make bad decisions. And so I think that speaks to, you know, the suppressing of it. In terms of Tarantino, I think that there is an argument with a lot of directors that they get so obsessed in their head with what it takes to get that perfect shot that they do, in fact, become a little sociopathic. Have you ever seen the movie The Stuntman with Peter O'Toole?
I don't think I have.
I would highly recommend it. It came out in the 1970s. There are a couple of cuts that are done very interestingly, but the whole point of the whole film is about a guy who happens onto a movie set. And the whole thing plays out as this metaphor for all of these sorts of things. But the director, played by Peter O'Toole, is very much a commentary on directors themselves and how they treat people. And so it seems to me that this winds up becoming a watershed moment for things like that to change. Because like you said, you know, accidents have happened. We were talking about this before, and, you know, it brings to mind Brandon Lee's death on the set of The Crow, where now there's an actor, because it wasn't good enough to cheat the camera angle and, you know, dub in and cut away and stuff like that. They had to fire, you know, a real gun with a blank in it, and it winds up, there's a real bullet that somehow gets in there and kills the guy. I think there's a whole range of things that can be addressed with this. And I, you know, so I'm just sort of hoping that this is, you know, because she made reference in the original New York Times article to confronting Tarantino, and she referred to it as the penny dropping for him, that she could see a light go on behind his eyes, where it was this sort of moment of truth for him, where he suddenly realized, oh my gosh, you know, like, that's very much the what I got from that part of the story that she related. And so the thought that went into my mind, because of course, you know, always thinking of things in movie analogies, is, stay with me here, it's not a one-to-one, but in Boogie Nights, Burt Reynolds' character, Jack Horner, with the colonel, when he goes and he sees him and the colonel's been arrested for a certain crime. And Jack Horner sits there and, hangs up the phone while the colonel's going, you know, are you my friend? Are you my friend, Jack? I think that that moment has happened now with Tarantino, where he has been, he's seen things now, he's realized certain things, where he has to say to himself, how did I not see this before? I was there. I was next to him. I saw him at the parties. I saw him at the... How did I willingly blind myself to what was going on? Is that me giving the benefit of the doubt to somebody too much? Maybe it is. I don't know. But I tend in that direction to... Hopefully he's now had that moment where he's like, I can't do that anymore.
I mean, you know, I guess the other side of this is, it's like, even if that's the case, since this is you know, by all accounts from people, you know, in the know, this is such a massive, you know, misjudgment on his part.
Yes.
You know? Something which every, I mean, this is like, you know, what you learn on, you know, the first day, you know, of directing school or whatever you want to call it, you know, the fact that he would disregard that, is it one of those things where it's like, well, he doesn't get another chance, you know? There are lots and lots of other filmmakers who are, you know, plenty talented, who are just waiting for their shot. And why not give it to someone who's not going to, you know, kill one of right. their actors?
Sure.
And I think that a lot of it, you know, a lot of the decision in that regard really should go to his collaborators, because you've got a bunch of people who have just signed up to make a movie with him. I'm guessing most of them did not know about this incident, and hearing about it now, there might be a lot of them who are like, yeah, no, I don't want to do that. Maybe not even just because of their own safety, but because of, you know, it obviously speaks a lot to Tarantino's character, like as a person, you know?
Sure.
And there, you know, there's probably a lot of people who are just like, I don't want to work with Tarantino anymore. A lot of people who maybe up until now would have loved to have worked with Tarantino, who are now like, nah, I'm good. You know, I can find another movie to make.
The thing that makes us even tougher is we're all of us one step removed from it.
Yeah.
In that we're analyzing it from the outside. Mm-hmm. And again, getting back to that, you know, that wanting to give the benefit of the doubt, shame could also keep somebody quiet about it for a long time. I have to believe if I'm going to give this guy another chance or whatever, that it's, I don't have a chance to give him, but you know what I'm saying. If I'm going to do that, I have to believe on some human level that he felt shame, that it wasn't like he was like, oh, screw it, it's in the past, right? Like he carried it, that there was something in his mind where it was like, this was a bad thing, I feel bad about this.
Right.
I have to believe that.
Yeah.
And
like
then,
he's legitimately remorseful.
Yeah. It's so weird to me. Like it's very bizarre for me because I'm very far removed from it, but you know, I did encounter, you know, in college and everything, there were directors who talked to people like they were just, you know, barnyard animals. And just, you know, like one of the things that always made me laugh in an episode, one of the few episodes of Friends I saw was one of the characters was in a play or whatever, Joey, and the director like dismisses him and just turns around and goes, where are my talking set pieces? And I was like, yeah, I see that. But you know, like it's even harder for me, for anybody, I think, to plug into it. And makes me wind up thinking about, I remember there was a story from the Phantom Menace set where a squib went off and like a spark got in Natalie Portman's eye. And apparently Lucas fired the guy who set the squid. He fired him on the spot. He was like, and he was questioned. They were like, how do you feel about that? You know, your reaction. And his response was, that shouldn't happen. And like yeah. That was all he said. That shouldn't happen, and that was it.
And I mean that seems perfectly reasonable. Mm-hmm. And you know, going by that rationale, then Tarantino shouldn't get another shot. But I guess you know, like you were saying, like should you know, are you going to give him another chance or whatever? And there, you know, we don't have a chance to give him. I mean, I guess that's the other thing about it is like we're talking about this in sort of the theoretical like. Should he get work again, when that really is not our call at all? I mean, I guess I can say, like, if I were in charge of a production or whatever, I'd probably be like, nah, I'm not going to hire him. Because I wouldn't want to take that chance. And I also am not necessarily sure I would want to take that chance away from someone else who may be more deserving of it. But, you know, speaking to in terms of that actually do relate to us, which is as consumers, do we give him another chance? Because there's certainly a lot of people now who like, you know, for example, I mean, there's, obviously there are a million filmmakers now who have recently been outed as being rather terrible individuals, and most of them will never make movies again. But if someone were to, and I mean, certainly there are some instances of people who have movies coming out, you know, or maybe not, would you go see those movies? And, you know, the answer to me for I think almost all of these people is nah, because even if this is a great movie, my enjoyment of it or my view of it is going to be tainted by the fact that I know it was made by someone who was a terrible human being.
See, I'm on board with that, and I completely understand, and it's completely valid. And yeah, there are parts where it's broken for me too, but like I think about, you know, and I mentioned my fandom of The Doors and everything, and as I've grown older, realizing that good Lord, Jim Morrison was not a good person. But like, you know the song Rock and Roll Part Two, right? You know what Gary Glitter went to prison for, right?
Yeah. And that's why you don't hear that at football stadiums anymore.
Right.
You know?
But it's like, it's if it were to come on the radio, like if I'm walking along and it comes on the radio, I don't, you know, like it is something where it's such a weird and complex sort of equation, I think, in people's heads of divorcing the art from the artist. Because I think there's a very long history of that, of people just accepting the idea that an artist is on some sort of core level a jackass. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying. And I think the difference there is you had a relationship with that song before you knew anything about Gary Glitter, right?
True.
Just like, I mean, this is what that critic was talking about, you know, that I mentioned earlier, where it's like Kill Bill. I mean, all of these movies, I mean, as we've discussed for the past 2 months, like all of these movies have had a huge impact on my life, right? And that doesn't change now that I know this about Tarantino. No. Like, I it's still, you know, sort of like made me the person that I am today, for better or worse. And I mean, the complicating factor in that, unlike something like, you know, I'm like, oh, well, X2 is still a good movie. You know, I'm not going to stop liking X2 anymore. You know, the difference between Tarantino movies and that is that, you know, as evidenced by this whole series, like his persona is sort of like intrinsically tied into his filmography, right?
Yeah.
So it's almost impossible to separate the art from the artist in this particular instance. And, you know, I mean, just to give an example, like I read the story and then immediately I had to watch The Hateful Eight for this series. Like, I mean, because it was the only time that I had. So it was literally like, okay, I'm about to watch Hateful Eight. Let me check the internet. Okay. So I read that and I'm like, now I need to watch a Quentin Tarantino movie, which is probably the last thing in the world I would have done at that particular point in time. And watching the movie, I was really sort of like conflicted because I was like, this is really well done. And yet everything that I saw in it, I kept on looking at it through the lens of, you know, someone who I had just lost a whole ton of respect for, you know what I mean? And I can only imagine now what Kill Bill is going to be like, because, you know, that's where this incident occurred. And that is, you know, like one of my all-time favorite movies. Like, in some ways, I'm kind of really glad that we just watched it for this series, because I'm probably not going to want to watch it again anytime soon, and I will never be able to enjoy it the way that I did this last time that I watched it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's that side of it, but then there's also the side of going forward. You know, it's like, okay, all of these are important to us. Pulp Fiction will never not be important to us, right? Mm-hmm. But what's going to happen with this Manson movie? And I mean, part of it is like, are we going to be able to enjoy it as much while we're watching it? And the fact that, you know, first impressions are so important in terms of this stuff, in terms of art, like, even if it is like his best movie from a technical standpoint, like I can't help but think that I'm going to be watching it from a distance, you know, and just kind of like looking at it much more analytically and not investing in it like emotionally in the same way that I have all of his other movies, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I hear you. I don't do it. Like I said, I don't discount it. I it's completely valid. What can you say to that? You know, like there's no counterpoint I'd offer to it. That's I get that. I totally get that.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I don't know. It's definitely really bummed me out, you know, because, and I know, you know, they say like never meet your idols or anything like that. And this is certainly an extension of that because, I mean, yeah, as much as we like to dissect, you know, someone's movies and say like, oh, look at this, you know, it's like we literally know nothing about them. You know, I've never met Quentin Tarantino. I don't know how he is as a human being. I mean, sometimes you can see things and you're like, oh, he's kind of a jerk.
No, but that's the thing that's sort of the thing to parse out is I think that what happens, and this is very especially curated, you know, over time by the publicists, by the producers, by the hype machine and everything like that, is they sell that emotional angle to you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just one more way to get you to go see them. Oh, come on. You know, you like what this guy does. You know, he seems like a pretty good. They do. They work that angle. I don't know if I don't think that's a new thing, but I think it's a new thing for it to be so omnipresent.
Yeah.
Like it used to be you had to achieve a certain level of something in order to get those puff pieces. But now everybody gets them. And in the age of social media, I think that there is this impression that we know people personally. When we do not, we never will. Until you interact with somebody personally, it ain't there. It doesn't matter whether you tweet them, whether they retweet you, whether you follow them, whether you interact on Facebook. Seriously.
Yeah, no,
because everybody,
true.
Everybody curates their personality online. Everybody self-markets now. And it's like, I sound like a big old cynical jerk and everything, but honestly, like, I think that's the only way to stay sane in the current world is to just be like, this is a version of a person that they want to present to me. This is not who they are. There is something they are not telling me about themselves.
Yeah. Well, whatever. It's, you know, it's been a bummer of a week and, you know, whatever. Although, you know, nothing nearly compared to what Uma Thurman went through. So, you know.
That is true. That is true.
Whatever. You know, I mean, it's all of this stuff, you know, it's been, you know, kind of like, you know, one by one, you know, and, yeah, you know, it's all for the better, you know, in my mind, because there are certainly not a lack of talent out there. And it's about time that other people who may not be jerks have a shot.
Yeah.
So yeah. But anyway, now that we've talked about that forever, it was something that, you know, it was just obviously something that needed to be covered. I mean, hey, this is the thing about this series is it's not like this is not just an episode about Hateful Eight. You know, our entire when we started on this, our entire goal was to look at, you know, this person's entire filmography. And now, you know, this new information has come to light, which is, you know, very, very relevant to the way that we look at that filmography. And, you know, you can't not address it. So,
yeah, you're absolutely right.
So with all that being said, should we talk about The Hateful Eight?
Let's talk about it briefly. Let's treat this long movie in a brief manner.
Okay.
And just sort of, you know, just so that we don't have to dwell on anything or, you know.
Yeah, okay.
That's all right.
We can. I did promise Brandon that we would get into a few little technical things. So
we
can talk about that for sure. But yeah, this is Tarantino's eighth movie. Do you want to just give a brief description of it?
Eight people get stuck in a cabin on a mountaintop during a blizzard, and they're not nice people.
That's pretty accurate, yeah.
We
talked last week about how it was originally, you know, conceived as a Django movie, you know, called Django and White Hell, and how it was altered because the character, which was originally going to be Django, had to be too mean, had to be too hateful for Django. So, you know, as these things, you know, happen, it was rewritten into something different. And it is a straight up Western. And it's, I think, really interesting in that it's a small story in the vein of, say, Reservoir Dogs. But it's told in a very epic way, you know, 3 hours long, 70 millimeter, anamorphic 70 millimeter, ultra Panavision 70, you know, as was in all of the marketing material, 70 millimeter release with, you know, roadshow prints with an intermission and blah blah blah, true epic filmmaking, but something that could be done on a stage, you know.
Yeah, it could.
Yeah. So, briefly, what are your thoughts on the movie?
I seem to hold it in higher regard than a lot of people that I know. I remember I did not get a chance to see this in the theater. You know, I always fall back at, well, you know, I'm a dad and everything. But seriously, you know, 3 hours long, I was like, oh, no, I can't do this. I can't, you know, because that's 5 hours of my life. But I, when I finally did get around to seeing it, I was legitimately just floored. And I remember reading the stuff leading up to it where they were, you know, talking about the racial aspect and all of that. And I think that it is, I mean, you know, in the context of this especially, it's such a beautiful, beautiful feels like the wrong word, but it is a beautiful metaphor for race relations and even, you know, gender relations, I guess, in the United States now. And each of these characters, even though they are all hateful, you know, for the most part, have layers to them that make them extremely interesting. And I think this is just a very compelling film.
Yeah, it is a really compelling film. I mean, you know, we talked about kind of the social commentary last week and everything, which is obviously, you know, present in any movie about, you know, slavery. And I think that, you know, this is kind of an extension of that in sort of a more refined way, because it's not as on the nose in a lot of ways. In what ways are people racist without, you know, just saying racist things, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, but I think that there's still a surprisingly, for as cynical a movie as you could paint The Hateful Eight, for, you know, the way the majority of the interactions go, there is this really, I thought, resonant sense of hopefulness about it. And it's specifically in Walton Goggins' character, you know, Mannix, where he is this way, he really is the way he is because that's how his daddy was and that's where he came from and that sort of thing. And you realize, though, by the end of the film that he is much more committed to a sense of right and wrong that snaps him out of that by the end of it.
And perhaps, you know, there's room for him to grow and change and break away from that, you know, generational, you know, racism.
Right.
Which, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, see, and this is the thing, like, can you watch a Tarantino movie from now on without looking for, you know, some sort of way to tie it back to what occurred on the set of Kill Bill? But is this, you know, Tarantino talking about himself in some sort of way and, you know, talking about, you know, someone who can change? I don't know. I think that that might be a stretch, but it's something which is running through my head now, you know, regardless.
Sure. It's sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, in the context of the story that just came out, you know, one of the things I looked at was what happens with Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, right? One of the questions I asked was, I think a great question to ask is somebody's reaction to this character different if it's a man than a woman in terms of how they relate to the character?
Yeah. And I mean, I guess I was thinking that, you know, when I first saw it, for sure, because, I mean, it definitely is rough, you know, watching this movie, for sure. And, I mean, I think he's intentionally trying to push those boundaries and everything. And, yeah, it really does make you think about, you know, all that stuff, which is all, you know, I think in a lot of ways tied into, you know, this whole thing that's going on in terms of, you know, misogyny in the industry and all that stuff. And I don't know. It's just like most of his movies, it doesn't really offer a lot of answers. It more asks the questions and sort of makes you develop the answers on your own.
Yeah.
Which is certainly interesting.
Yeah, the one thing that I would definitely say that I take issue with is the story that Sam Jackson tells right before the intermission didn't need to have the depiction of how the old man was seeing it in his head. I think Sam Jackson's performance is good enough, and what I really paid attention to this time was Sam Jackson's performance is good enough there, and then there's a later instance of somebody relating a story without that overlay. And so I just don't understand why that overlay is specifically needed in that, except maybe to drive home. I've always rationalized it as it drives home in specific what the old man is seeing in his head, but I don't think it was necessary. So
yeah, I mean, I think he could have definitely gotten away with not doing that, but I guess, and I know that a lot of people have had a problem with that. I guess I've never personally had a problem with that. I think the way that he does it is very effective because it is so brutal in a lot of ways that it really sort of like gets that point across in a way that just talking about it wouldn't. And I don't know. I think that it's pretty effective in that particular instance. But, you know, I can understand why people are bothered by it for sure, you know?
Yeah.
So, okay. Should we talk a little bit about the technical aspect? Because it's fascinating to
I want nerds. To know more about it. I know that, like the whole camera thing, I have trouble keeping it even in my head about the special camera with the lenses and the ultra Panavision and, you know, six people have used them and they have to use a special incantation from the Necronomicon to get Panavision to give them to them or something like that.
I mean, I can read from the program, which was given out at the Roadshow Productions for the 70mm, which is fairly interesting. Ultra Panavision 70 refers to the very rare and exceptional format that Tarantino and his team used to shoot The Hateful Eight. Panavision's unique anamorphic camera lenses capture images on 70mm film in an incredible aspect ratio of 2.76 to 1. If you watch this movie, which is available on Netflix along with Cloverfield Paradox, you will see that the black bars on the top and bottom of the screen are much larger than most movies, and the reason is because the movie is very, very wide. As it goes on to say, almost all films you see today are shot in ratios of either 1.85 to 1, which is basically like if you're watching a movie on your TV without black bars, or 2.39 to 1, which would basically be a movie with black bars, which would be basically all of the Star Trek movies. So to put it simply, Ultra Panavision 70 provides an amazingly wider and more detailed image. Only a handful of films have ever been made in this format, including Ben-Hur, Mutiny on the Bounty, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, Battle of the Bulge, and in 1966, Khartoum, the last time a motion picture was made in this format. So basically what happened was, you know, they were looking for a way to make this movie unique. Tarantino, obviously always in love with film, 70mm being, an epic scale format. His cinematographer, Robert Richardson, was at Panavision looking around, you know, looking at lenses and stuff, and he sees a bunch of wedge-shaped lenses sitting in a corner, and he's like, hey, what are those? And his guide or whoever was like, oh, those are, you know, Ultra Panavision 70 lenses. You know, that's what, you know, you use to shoot anamorphic 70mm. And he looked at them, he tested them out. He's like, this is amazing. This is what we need. And he used them. Like, they were the same exact lenses which were used to shoot Ben-Hur. And what it does for you know, to put it in, you know, layman's terms, like 70mm is basically like, well, IMAX literally is 70mm film, although it's basically three times the size of 70mm in the standard sense. 70mm is basically about a little more than two times as large as 35mm. And that gives you a much, you know, sharper image because the frame is so much bigger. You can pack a lot more detail on there. And it was big in like the 50s and 60s. And it's sort of made a comeback with like Christopher Nolan and Paul Thomas Anderson shooting movies like The Master and, well, I mean, all, you know, The Dark Knight and Inception and, you know, things all the way up through, you know, most recently, Dunkirk was shot in 70mm. Now, the anamorphic thing, like, that's what you see normally. What you're doing is you see anamorphic in movies like Star Trek, which take 35mm film and stretch it out into that widescreen format. With 70 millimeter, it's already in that widescreen format. So when you stretch it out, it becomes super wide. The trick here is, for one thing, those lenses that Robert Richardson saw sitting in the corner of Panavision are pretty much the only 70 millimeter lenses, or anamorphic 70 millimeter lenses, in existence. So there's that side of it. The other side of it is you need those anamorphic 70 millimeter lenses to project it. You need to have those on your non-existent 70 millimeter projectors. So how do you do that?
Yeah.
And the answer is you hire a projection company to go around the country, dig up every single 70 millimeter projector that they can find, have them grab pieces of each and stick them all together until you get, you know, I forget how many it was, whether it's 100 or whatever, that actually work. Find as many of those anamorphic lenses as you can, build new ones for the theaters that, you know, that don't have them, and then ship them out across the country along with projectionists and 70 millimeter prints in order to show this, you know, in a very special presentation. And they did it, which is insane, but also very impressive.
Yeah, and I will always regret they had that near me, and I wasn't able to get to go see it, and I was heartbroken about it. It was very disappointing to me that I wasn't able to get out. I would have had to go all the way out to we have an AFI theater. Well, I don't live near there anymore. Up in Silver Spring, Maryland, the AFI theater was showing it, and I didn't get the chance to go. Oh well.
I went opening night, Christmas night, after going to three different, you know, family Christmas dinners or whatever. We all ventured out to the Music Box in Hateful Eight-like conditions. You know, it was freezing, and we had to wait in the long line, which was going down the block, in order to get into the theater. And it was totally worth it, you know, because, I mean, it was cool seeing it up on the big screen and whatever, in this format, which no one had ever watched any movies on for like 50 years. And also, the roadshow version was longer. He added a few scenes and a few shots and everything in order to make it, I think, about like 15 minutes longer, if I'm not mistaken. And there was an intermission in the middle, which it was weird, because when I did see it again, you know, in a regular digital theater without that footage and without the intermission, it actually felt a lot longer, because I feel like the intermission gives you a break in order to sort of like collect your thoughts and everything like that, and sort of recharge your batteries before going back in for the big finale. So even though the roadshow version was longer, it feels shorter, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. No, it's not weird. It totally makes sense. I mean, it's, you know, because, you know, if you have a two-act play, the second act's always shorter.
Yeah.
And, you know, they pack everything in the first, and then you have your intermission, you come back, and, you know, you jump back into it. So,
and for those people wondering, because he basically has decided that, like, if you're not watching it in 70 millimeter, you don't need all that extra stuff. It's, you know, more about the expansiveness of it than you know, any sort of like storytelling thing. So when you're watching it at home, he feels that, you know, the standard theatrical version plays better. So for those people who are wondering where that intermission occurs, it's right after that story that we were talking about, right before the
Domergue's chapter is called
like Domergue's Got a Secret. Yeah, right before that. So anyway, just one last thing, because Brandon was asking about it. He's like, how come, and you hear this all the time with 70 millimeter, they say like it was shot in 65 millimeter, but then released in 70 millimeter. Like, why is there that difference? And it's weird. I mean, I honestly don't understand why there's that difference, but there is that difference. And the reason for it is because, I think probably because film is so expensive, they're trying to cut, you know, costs wherever they can. 65 millimeter film and 70 millimeter film, in terms of the picture size, are exactly the same. The difference is that those extra 5 millimeters are where they put the soundtrack. So when it comes to shooting 35 millimeter, when they're shooting it, you also lose, you know, space on the frame for the soundtrack, but that area is basically just blank, essentially, on the film which you're filming. You know, it's area which you are never meant to see and never will see. But with 70 millimeter, they use the entire frame of 65 millimeter film that they have, and then they print that onto 70 millimeter, which is wide enough to stick that soundtrack on the side. So it's just a weird little quirk thing, but, you know, 65 millimeter, 70 millimeter, essentially the same thing.
Here's a question for you, because Ultra Panavision, you know, gets all of this data and information that, you know, you don't get otherwise, anamorphic, all of that stuff. Do you foresee a future where they can achieve this digitally?
Well, I guess the answer is yes. I mean, here's the thing, like Ultra Panavision, 70 millimeter anamorphic, it's no extra resolution. It's no extra anything. All that it does is it takes the image and it stretches it out. So it takes that frame and makes it wider. But, you know, all of those, let's say, square crystals, if you want to, I mean, they're not square, they're crystal shaped, whatever. They're now rectangular crystals, you know? So no more quality, just a wider screen, right?
Okay.
And to answer the question, can you do that? Can you do that digitally? The answer is yes. And it has been done digitally, because here's the thing, right? Like the way that digital cameras are kind of constructed, a lot of them anyway, the sensors, the chips, which are used to collect the visual information, are designed to basically mimic the size of film, because that way you can use film lenses in order to shoot your movies and everything.
Okay.
So, you know, like most sensors, camera sensors are basically the same size as like 35 millimeter. So you can use those 35 millimeter lenses that have existed forever. Now what you start seeing is, you know, Alexa, I think in particular, has developed a camera which has a much larger chip which mimics 70 millimeter film, you know?
Okay.
And that's been used on a number of movies like The Revenant and Sully. And that's now, if you ever see something, say, like, shot in IMAX, you know, digital IMAX, that's basically what it is, lies. But, you know, the new Avengers movies are shot in this, and a bunch of movies are shot in it now. And it looks fantastic. But you're usually using your standard 70 millimeter lenses, which are, whatever, spherical and whatever.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing just because while you talk about, you know, the LIMAX and everything like that, I'm just thinking about every time Marvel, you know, like Black Panther or the Avengers, like, see, 26% more picture in your frame. You're like, what the hell does that even mean?
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Yes. And that's what they do now, like with Sully and everything. And they're doing that with Avengers and all this stuff. But you can't do that if you use, and this is something which can be done now, you use these lenses, and there's still only just those couple lenses that were used for Ben-Hur or whatever. You can use those on these new digital cameras because the shape of the sensor is the same. So you can get that amazing anamorphic 70 millimeter look, like from a lens standpoint, but on a digital image. And that combination of, you know, this 50-year-old technology with this, you know, brand new technology is really kind of amazing looking. And if you want to see a movie that does it, Rogue One did it. Rogue One used the same lenses that were used for The Hateful Eight, but with a digital image. Now, you might say, like, well, Rogue One isn't super wide. Well, the reason is because they cropped the sides in order to make it just your standard 2.39:1.
And let's throw the caveat out there that 60 to 70% of Rogue One was shot like that, and the rest probably wasn't.
Sure, yeah. Not all of it was, but a lot of it was, and it looks great. And Robert Richardson did the same thing himself with the new Ben Affleck movie, Live by Night. He shot that.
Oh.
Which, terrible movie, Looks amazing though. So
it did look very nice. Yes, it did.
So not
nuts about the final product though.
Yes, no, for sure. It's bad. But to answer your question, yes, you can do this, you know, with digital now, you know, to some degree.
Somebody start whispering to Nolan right now. Maybe that's how we can get Nolan over to digital. Yeah?
No, because he doesn't care about that. You know, he wants the actual feel of the film, the photochemical thing. Nothing's ever going to get Nolan to go digital. Nothing at all. Same thing with Paul Thomas Anderson. So
probably true. Yeah.
And same thing with Quentin Tarantino. For sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, all right. Okay. Well, we've talked about the controversy. We've talked about
a lot of stuff. Yeah.
Hateful Eight here, and we've talked about all of Tarantino's movies over the past, you know, few months. So, I mean, this question a lot more complicated than it was, you know, just a couple days ago, but do you still want Tarantino to make Star Trek?
Yeah, I would like to see a Tarantino Star Trek movie, but I wouldn't be heartbroken if he doesn't. You know, like, I think if you asked me a week ago, you know, the news of Tarantino being like, oh, we shuttered it, we're not going to do the Star Trek movie, like a week ago, I'm like, oh, damn it, no. And now I just be like, okay.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I kind of think my answer is no, you know, because... I mean, like, I keep on thinking about this, and I mean, this is, I mean, just one example of a billion in the sports world, but, you know, Aroldis Chapman, who was the closer for the Chicago Cubs when they won the World Series, you know, he started off the season on the Yankees, but he started off the season, you know, suspended for 30 games for, you know, choking his girlfriend. And, you know, the whole time, and I mean, it's like, this is nothing new to anything, but like the whole time that this was happening, it's like, you know, oh, well, you know, he's on the Yankees, you know, once his suspension is over, they're going to get a major boost. It's almost going to be like, you know, making a trade mid-season, you know, because they're going to get, you know, this amazing arm in the bullpen. And then that happened, and then when the Yankees season tanked, they put him up for, you know, sale, essentially, on the trade market, and the Cubs picked him up. And I kept on thinking, I mean, I'm not a Cubs fan at all, but I live in Chicago, so I see all the media and everything, and I deal with a lot of Cubs fans, and I kept on thinking, like, if I'm a Cubs fan, and I'm on the verge of winning the first World Series, you know, in my lifetime or anyone else's, like, am I really going to want to do it with this guy as a key component? Like, yeah. I'm going to be morally conflicted, you know? And I kind of feel the same way here, where it's like, yeah, I have absolutely no doubt that Tarantino would make maybe the best Star Trek movie ever. Certainly one which is the most unique Star Trek movie ever. And yet there's no shortage of talented filmmakers out there who are, you know, just absolutely ready to make Star Trek movies and who can make, you know, four-star, you know, Star Trek movies, you know, without any problem in order to not be sitting in that theater and thinking like, this is the best Star Trek movie that's ever been made. It's too bad it was made by a jackass. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I do. And I, you know, not to diminish at all, but I always go back to the whole Jim Morrison thing. Mm-hmm. I still listen to The Doors. I still know everything. I have all their albums on vinyl still from when I was like much younger, and I still listen to them. And I compartmentalize and I just put it in the back of my brain, you know, because in a similar fashion, Morrison was lionized, fetishized, idolized, and, you know, had a glowing biopic done on his behalf, which is just more than 80% baloney. But, you know, it was still, he was, you know, the cool troubled artist and everything like that. And then you get older and you realize you read real stories about him and you think, and you know, you learn that like David Crosby won't even talk about the guy Like, and when somebody asked him, it was like, why don't you like Jim Morrison? He's like, I'm not going to talk about it. And it's like, oh no, that doesn't sound good.
Yeah.
But I still listen to their music, you know?
Yeah. 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 And I guess the thing that I keep on going back to in that regard is like, if all of a sudden Jim Morrison were to come back from the dead and record a new album,
I'd be scared because that is a hell of a thing to do.
But would you be like excited about it? Would you be like, I mean, I don't know. I like, it's hard.
It's so impossible to, but I get what you're going for there. I do. I don't know if maybe there's, you know, because the thing is, you know, when, I mean, there's a different, maybe it's not so different, but like, you know, my idolization of Morrison was so tied to my teen years and all of that stuff. And the constant drumbeat with it was, I mean, even when they were presenting him as the legend and everything like that, they were very much like, you know, he was a drug addict and an alcoholic and not a nice guy when he partook of those things, which was like every day of his life. Mm-hmm. But this music's awesome and he was a great poet. And like, it just sort of, I guess, conditioned me to just accept the idea, you know, like, and that's terrible to say, to even think it. And I wouldn't want to ever meet him. I would never want to see him. I would never want to talk to him.
Yeah.
Because he just seems like, you know, John Densmore, who was in the band, like hated him.
Yeah.
Like hated him, quit the band numerous times because he couldn't stand him. And kept getting talked back in. It's like, no, look what we're doing, you know, sort of thing. So, and now I'm rambling, but
I mean, that is sort of like the thing. I mean, that's the thing which historically people have done. I mean, the thing that everyone talks about, you know, it was 2003 when Roman Polanski was given a standing ovation at the Oscars, which is insane to think of.
Yeah, pretty nuts, isn't it?
And you know, I mean, Woody Allen. I mean, I've known about this Woody Allen stuff for as long as I've been watching Woody Allen movies. And I have to say that, you know, every time I'd watch one, I'd be like, I'm surprised that that person would want to work with Woody Allen. It's weird that that happened. But I guess that's just kind of the way things are. And like, I kind of accepted it blindly. And now that, you know, people are finally starting to say, like, how about we don't do that?
Yeah,
I can't really argue with that. You know, I'm just like, yeah, I'm on board with not doing that anymore. Like, I'm okay not seeing another Woody Allen movie for the rest of my life. You know what I mean?
Right. I'm completely with you because, like, I just think about, you know, HR, you know, like if I,
yeah,
you know, like if I was working with somebody like that, I'd be like, look, you either fire this jackass or I'm out.
Right.
I'm done.
Yeah, no.
You know, and
right. I mean,
I'm
like,
gone.
We're having this like philosophical debate about these artists because, I don't know, I think because we look at them in an abstract way. But whenever I think about it in like a real world setting, like take out the filmmaking aspect of it and put it in an office, I'm like, let's fire Tarantino now, you know, and never say his name again. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I mean, yeah. That's it. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. So there you go. It's just, you know, and I mean, I guess we'll get into this, you know, now, but it's like, there was so much joy, I think, on the part of both of us going into this series. Like, as soon as the news dropped, I mean, you can go back and listen to those episodes, and it's like we were so excited about the idea of Quentin Tarantino making a Star Trek movie. And, you know, it was like nothing could stop that enthusiasm, you know, to the point that we decided to dedicate the next 2 months to you know, watching and covering his movies and talking about how awesome he is. And then we get to the end here, and it's like, and no, you know, like, and now there's this, and it's just like, it's such a bummer, you know? I mean,
yeah.
That, I mean, I don't know about another word to use there. That's probably an inappropriate way of describing it, but
no, I don't think anybody would fault you for that. I think that there's also going to be a lot of, I think there's a lot of interest on a lot of people's parts, not just ours, about when he eventually gives his first interview.
Yeah.
He's been distant. He has obviously consciously removed himself from the mix of everything.
Yeah.
And I think that when that first interview happens, it's going to be real interesting to see how it breaks.
For sure. For sure. You know, I mean, hearing, you know, Uma Thurman's clarification, I found that to be really interesting, you know, and it's yeah. made me more conflicted than I was, you know, before reading that. But I don't know. Whatever. It's, I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, I'll never be able to watch one of his movies again without being sort of like tainted by this news, you know, without it being tainted by this news.
But sure.
Whatever. It is what it is. All right. So we limped across the finish line in some fashion.
Yeah.
So on to some more.
Speaking of finish lines.
Yeah, fun and exciting news, yeah. I guess.
Yeah.
Now that we've brought everyone down, let's just, pile on with some, you know, somewhat personal news. But we've decided that we're going to be ending Stage 9.
Yep.
In a couple weeks. When we started this show, whether by design or not, it sort of became quickly the Who's Working on Discovery show. You know, which was a lot of fun because, you know, I mean, the show was actually responsible for generating some of that news, and it became this sort of like puzzle that we were trying to solve, and in putting it all together, we were trying to figure out what this show would be like. And it was really, really a lot of fun because we were driving towards something. And then we got there when Discovery came out. And then it was like, okay, now what do we do? Now what do we talk about?
Yeah.
And I think we both kind of felt like we pretty much said all there was to say. You know, we've been having this discussion in one way or another for over 4 years at this point.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think we've pretty much covered everything. And we were feeling drained. We were feeling, you know, burnt out. We were kind of looking for a way out. And then when the Tarantino news broke, we were like, this is the perfect way to end it because this is so exciting.
Yeah.
We'll go out on a high. Yeah. It'll be amazing. It'll be so much fun. And it's a way to sort of bring it full circle to, you know, when we started with, you know, commentary Trek Stars and bring it back to that format. You know, all those people that we talked about, you know, none of them could compare in our minds to Tarantino. Keep in mind, this was, you know, more than a week ago that we were having this
yes,
conversation.
That's true. That's true.
And so we thought, well, this is the perfect way to end it. There's no way that it can ever get better than this. So we decided, you know, looking at the numbers, looking at where we're at, you know, just a few episodes away from number 79. 79 seems the perfect place to end it, obviously, with, you know, the same number as the original series and all that stuff. So that's what we're doing. You know, we just finished the Tarantino series right here and now, and we've got two episodes left. And with Discovery ending, another very sort of like happy coincidence, all these things sort of like lining up perfectly. You know, next week, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about Discovery on the whole and about all the people who we've been talking about for the past, you know, couple years and how, you know, the finished product turned out, you know, based on everything that we saw and everything that we were hoping for and whatever, you know, what was, you know, surprising, what was disappointing, you know, what did we get right, what did we get wrong in terms of, you know, what we thought we were going to see from a creator standpoint, and just, you know, break down the whole show.
Yeah.
And then for episode 79, we're going to wrap it all up with a These Are the Voyages style finale.
No, if we wrap it up with a These Are the Voyages style finale, it's going to be Max talking for an hour. And then I'm going to electrocute myself, and then you're going to go talk to a bunch of people. And I'm not down for electrocuting myself, Mike. Okay. I ain't going out like that.
Sort of like thematically speaking, you know, the idea of what it was supposed to be, sort of like a look back on all of our time at Trek FM and not just Stage 9.
As a cute and fun story, I have electrocuted myself, just not fatally. It sucked. Well, it was pretty bad.
That sounds terrifying.
Yes. When one tries to do one's own home improvements, sometimes you flip the wrong breaker. So there you go.
So that's what we're going to do. You know, it's been a lot of fun. You know, we've been on the network for a very long time now, but I think we both have other challenges which we want to pursue. And
yes,
we're gonna do that for a while. You know, I'm happy with the work that we've done. You know, I think that that people have enjoyed it for the most part, and I think we've enjoyed doing it for the most part. But I think it's time to move on to other challenges,
other sectors of the galaxy, as it were.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been quite an evening talking about Quentin Tarantino and Hateful Eight.
Yes.
Tonight, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
This episode is one of those tropes. Like, why is Jack the Ripper something that just completely still captivates us in storytelling?
It's interesting. People are always obsessed. Like, you always see some new documentary on the History Channel, like, we found the new Jack the Ripper. Was Jack the Ripper a woman? Was Jack the Ripper a political figure? Was he a part of the royal family? It's like, do we care at this point?
The 602 Club.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I love the fact that the theme of PTSD carries through, and the very first thing that they do is they throw at you, they double underline, circle, and bold the point that revenge doesn't chase the demons away.
Earl Grey.
I dragged him over to Seth MacFarlane, who I'd never met before, and I said, so you're a big Star Trek Next Gen fan? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, I'm Lieutenant Commander Shelby. And he looked at me and he went, that means you're Elizabeth Denny. I suppose that's why someone like you sits in the shadow of a great man, passing off one command after he started saying all of my lines to me. And we started doing all of our scenes and lines. Isn't that hilarious?
Warp 5.
The Guardians are the Borg.
That's it. The Guardians are the Borg.
Tune in later on. We might talk about it.
Let's write that episode together.
Right. See, but the thing is that these sphere builders, though, like they must think of themselves as the guardians of the galaxy.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact, choose to send to a show, and select Stage 9. That'll come right to us, and you can also find the network on Twitter at trekfm, and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me as Kessel Junkie out there. You can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And over on the Nerd Party Network, you can find me co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Matthew Rushing and Great Shot Kid with you.
And you can find me over there on thenerdparty.com doing Great Shot Kid. And you can also find me right back here on Trek FM doing The Edge, specifically Tracks from the Edge. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. We'd like to thank our associate producers today and for, you know, all of their time here for the past, you know, couple years. Of course, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman C. Lau.
Thank you very much, guys.
If you'd like to be like Norm, Jeff, and Chris, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm, where you can become a patron of the network. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you can find all of the details, including perks like early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. All right. Well, that wasn't quite the victory lap we were hoping for, but I think it was an important conversation, and I'm glad that we had it.
Yeah.
And next week, we are going to move on to brighter things with a look at Star Trek Discovery.